Welcome to Casting the Net, where we are uncovering some of the items about public health you may not be aware of. We are the Northeast Texas Public Health District. We are the local health department for the city of Tyler and for Smith County. And our guest today is the director of our environmental health department, Miss Ginger Points. I'm pretty confident in saying that you are the original and only spice that we've had here at NetHealth. I may be showing my age a little bit because we haven't had anybody named Sporty or Posh.
No.
Or Scary. We're Scary Spice. Posh Spice.
I'm not familiar with this.
Baby Spice.
Just the ginger.
But they're the ginger spice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They're the ginger spice.
That's going right over my
head. You remember the Spice Girls?
No. I could probably run back like the lyrics of maybe like one chorus or something, maybe, but it was probably like one song.
And that's probably enough.
Yeah.
It's probably good that you don't. You know, they were back in the phase, Backstreet Boys, NSYNC,
yeah.
Britney Spears, and that the late 90s.
Yeah.
The bubblegum pop, as it was called. I don't know what you were doing back in the late 90s, Ginger.
Late 90s. Volleyball. That was pretty much my
Oh,
my
you're
focus
a volleyball player?
At that point. Yes, it is. Yes, I am.
Were you an outside spiker? Were you a setter? Were you specialty serving?
Depends.
Fielding?
High school versus college. So, spiker, a little bit outside. Yes, I'm not tall enough to be a middle. Not at all. But setter, transition into college play, setter and defense.
Nice.
Yes. So this is a layer that we do in our podcast where we get to learn a little bit more about the employee. Your day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month duty is as the director of our environmental health department, but it seems like you have a very vivid past. Like, I didn't know before.
That's the first time I
was talking right now that you were an avid volleyball player.
Southern Conference champions. That's right.
Ooh, listen to that.
1997.
Wow. Yeah.
That's impressive.
No modesty at all. But
yeah. The fact that we've never heard that.
Yeah. And where was that you played?
Lamar University in
Beaumont.
Beaumont. Yeah.
I went to Lamar. Well, I didn't go there. I went to a summer camp there for a few years. I'm assuming the smell of sulfur in the air probably hadn't changed.
Smell of money.
Smell of money.
Yes. Grew up in the Golden Triangle. That's right.
So
we dig it out of the ground up here and we refine it down there.
So you were born and raised in the Beaumont area?
Nederland, yes.
In Nederland?
Mm-hmm.
So how did a Nederlandian?
Oh, no.
Nederlandite?
That's like, bad. Just born
so,
there.
So how's a volleyball player from Nederland, Beaumont, how do you evolve to becoming the environmental health director for NetHealth? What was that journey?
It was. That's exactly what it was. It was a journey. I did not know a health department existed all the way through college.
You never got sick? Never had to see a doctor
yes.
for anything?
Oh, yes. Got sick, for sure. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, looking back, you know, as a food inspector now, yes, I made myself sick growing up on leftovers, for sure. Yes, I did. Growing up, middle school, that was my, time where I tried to figure out career path and which direction I wanted to go. And at that time, it was a veterinarian. I like animals. Grew up outsidesy kind of girl. We were outside on the weekends for sure. You know, my family, my mom and dad, they met in college at North Texas and got married and moved to Woodville, not too far from here, but started teaching careers and all of that. And in their off time, they bought a few motorcycles and ran around the countryside. And that ended up being kind of their hobby on the side growing up, even through having us and all of that, was, on the weekends we went to go play. We'd ride motorcycles on the weekend if it And as we grew older, it was turned into sports. Very sports driven family. My dad played football college, and mom was athletic. She didn't play necessarily, but she did run track, but I don't think it was for the university. But
I think when you become a mom, it's kind of a side comment. When you become a mother, you become athletic because you're a mom. Because you develop agility and balance and strength.
What do they say? Find that sixth gear or something like that? Or that seventh gear, whatever the term is.
That you didn't know that you had until the baby comes out. And, you know, the strength of a mother, you know, if your child is trapped under a car, a mom can literally lift up a car to save her child.
Yeah.
You know, that. So I can see that you're saying your mom wasn't. No, your mom was an athlete.
She was, definitely. She is a sportsy person, for sure. PE degree. That was science and physical ed is kind of her thing. Pretty athletically driven. That was, you know, you're either an academic, you get a scholarship that way, or you go the athletic route and get a scholarship that way. But it was the mindset, you know, for us growing up. And so we were definitely sports track. So, you know, played everything, volleyball, basketball, track, you name it, through middle school, kind of tailored it down just a little bit. And sophomore, junior, senior year of high school, and kind of honed in on volleyball. And that was the sport that we'd chosen. So then it was, you know, we'd go either ride motorcycles or we were in the Junior Olympics and during summer leagues and stuff like that for volleyball to hone skills and do what we needed to do to make sure we got scholarships pretty much for college. And so did that. And somewhere in the middle of late high school, I figured my study habits were not too conducive for the competitive nature of veterinary school, you know, acceptance. So I settled for wildlife management or something along those lines. Still kind of dealing with animals, keeping that outside, outdoorsy kind of, you know, path that we kind of grew up with because I enjoyed it a lot. And so that's kind of what I went to school for. I started out biology major and did that for a few years and then switched to environmental science with the idea of, you know, still wildlife management or some kind of industrial hygiene kind of focused job, something like that. And I liked the limnology. That was one of the classes I liked. I liked fish, aquariums and that kind of thing. And so
that's a new term for me. I've never
limnology.
Limnology.
Yeah. As opposed to oceanography or whatever, right? So that's mm-hmm. a study of freshwater, pretty much. And so that was fun. Enjoyed that a lot. And so then I was kind of looking for jobs at the LNVRA, Lower Neches River Authority, something like that. And so that was kind of my thoughts on jobs. I applied for a few with the Texas Parks and Wildlife and the River Authority and, you know, various different places and things like that. And out of college, this job was open. And my in-laws kind of wanted us to move up here to be closer to them and help out with their church activities and things like that they had going. And so I was qualified for the job, and I applied and interviewed and got the job.
And you've blessed Nest Health with how many years of service now?
18.
18 years.
Now, when you say you got the job, so you were hired
got
under
the job.
Those of you that lived in the Tyler Smith County area for a while, bless her soul, you were hired by Brenda Elrod.
Miss Brenda Elrod.
Like, hey, Ginger, how you doing? What's going on today? I can't do a true, authentic Brenda Elrod impersonation, but those of you that met Brenda, she's kind of an unforgettable personality.
Yes, she is. No, she's a wonderful, wonderful mentor. Growing up, I was very fortunate to learn under her and learn the ropes and gain the skills necessary to make sure that we've got a good program here at the health district.
So you were hired 18 years ago. How long have you been director over environmental health?
That transition happened in 2015.
So that is 9 years?
Yeah.
Going on 10?
Unbelievably, yes. Time is flying.
Does it feel like it's been 9 years?
No, it honestly does not. It does not. No. I think we're rocking along, doing okay, just trying to keep up with the economic growth, just the growth in the area. It's been a challenge for us.
Yeah, so speaking of growth, we're going to volley to another topic. See what I did there, y'all? Okay. I don't have a pun yet for limnology.
Right.
I'll think of one somehow, some way. But of Smith County, we have 8 major cities. We have Tyler, White House, Troop, Bullard, Arp, Winona, Lyndale, Overton. And Overton is actually split across 3 counties, believe it or not, y'all. There's a part of Overton in Smith County, there's a part in Gregg County, and there's a part of Overton in Rusk County. But we still count it. Smith. Mm-hmm. Then we have Chapel Hill. So that's actually 9. And then
Noonday,
Flint, Swan. But any food establishment that operates within Smith County is within your jurisdiction. So just a guesstimate, just for everybody to kind of orient themselves. How many total food establishments, just a ballpark number, how many food establishments operate that have a permit with environmental health? How many are there in Smith County?
About 1,682.
Oh, I just want a random number. That was...
I think that might be the number. No estimation needed.
Somewhere around that number. It grows daily.
Okay.
Yes.
So because Tyler is the largest city, what's your guesstimate or exact number? How many food establishments are there within the city of Tyler?
There is about 1,200, somewhere in that ballpark.
So that's three-fourths.
Yeah, it's about, honestly, it's about a 60-40 split. City of Tyler has about 60% of our job responsibilities, and the remainder of all Smith County is about that 40%.
All I hear is couples shouldn't be arguing about where to eat. There's so many places to eat.
You have plenty.
And I always pick the same 4.
It's like, where are you going to eat tonight? Oh, you got 1,682 different places that you...
Me and the wife were talking about that the other night. We were like, we should just make a list and force ourselves to follow that list of, like, if we're eating out on the weekend somewhere, it's like we have to go to the next one on the list. Like, we can't... But I know that we'll find a way to be like, nah, we'll go 3 or 4 down on the list, you know?
Okay, so here's some quick math for y'all. Okay, you said in Smith County, there's 16, well, even go with just City of Tyler. Right. You said about 1,200 food establishments. Now, when you say food establishment, if you'll give a definition there, what counts as a food establishment? And then I have a
good
stat
question
to throw.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is a food establishment?
So it is anything retail food. So that is food offered for human consumption. So the food establishment makes it and offers it to the final consumer. That's under our purview. So versus manufactured food. The state of Texas inspects for food that's wholesaled or manufactured and then sent to the retailer. So we pick it up from retail food to final consumer. And so the things that require inspection are any business or any person that wants to have open food handling or temperature controlled food service, regardless of sale. And so that's, milk or dairy or proteins. Well, milk and dairy, yeah, same thing. But anyway, so your milk, dairy, your proteins, or any cooked food is then temperature sensitive. So if you're going to do any of that, that's something that we would inspect for time and temperature controls. But anything open food, and that's as simple as scooping ice or pouring up a drink, you know. So that involves clean utensils and food hand washing and stuff like that. So we can get pulled in for inspections on establishments such as that is for things that simple. So we handle concession stands, convenience stores, retail groceries, fast food places, full service, hospitals, nursing homes, schools, you name it.
So is it fair to say any place that provides food to the general public?
Chances are, yes. There are a few.
Any business that provides food to the general public.
With a few carve-outs, of course. Mm-hmm. As the years go on, legislation makes things more and more confusing and complicated. And so there is a cottage food production law that allows certain foods, non-perishable foods, such as cakes, cookies, breads, things of that sort, to be made and sold from home with zero permit. So that's something to, if anybody's interested in doing that, that, you know, we can guide you through those state regulations to do that in a correct way. But that absolutely does not include tamales, casseroles, barbecues, meats, okay, so things of that sort.
I've been considering trying to start a side hustle. So you said cakes. I'm going to take some notes. Cakes.
Yes.
I could do cookies.
Yes.
And what was the other? You said cake, cookies, and
breads, jams, jellies.
Any of y'all listening, and this is no shot at you, Terrence. I've been to Terrence's house. He has a clean home. I'm just saying, be mindful of whose food you eat.
You can't eat everybody's potato salad. Or cake.
That's kind of one of the key reasons of having a health department that oversees some of these things. I know Ginger can attest to it. As many of our environmental health inspectors can. They've seen a thing or two.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy out there, and that is why health departments exist. That's why inspectors exist. Is because people knowingly or unknowingly do silly things that can pose risks to our health and safety. You know, and so. Especially things that we ingest, you know, anything that we put in our mouth, put in our bodies, you know, it can make us healthy or it can harm us. And so that's where we try to, you know, use that science-based approach, use that risk-based approach to make sure that foods are handled and served in a safe way. And so we cannot do that from a place that does not receive inspections or anything like that. So mm-hmm. It's important.
I feel we take sanitarians for granted when we go to eat at a restaurant because we have that base level assumption that the food that we're going to order from that restaurant, from that food establishment, is safe because they're open for business. That is a service that our sanitarians do for food establishments in Smith County. So, as you enjoy your next meal or meals, as y'all go out to eat, you know how they say, thank a farmer?
Mm-hmm.
Thank a sanitarian.
For sure.
So this quick stat I have, you mentioned there's 1,200 food establishments in Smith County. So there's 365 days in a year. So if you went to a different restaurant every day in a year, you went to one restaurant for breakfast on January 1st, you go to a different restaurant for lunch January 1st. You go to a different restaurant dinner January 1st. You keep going to a different restaurant every single day in a year. You would not cover every food establishment within a calendar year. That's how many food establishments we have permitted by our Environmental Health Department here in Smith County.
That's a lot.
There's more. So that number, 365 days, three meals a day, that's 1,095 meals. And you said there's 1,200 plus. So it's like a challenge I want to take one year. I want to see if I can go to every single restaurant. Now, that doesn't include if it's a chain restaurant that has multiple locations in Tyler, you know, your McDonald's, Subway, Chick-fil-A, Raising Cane's, et cetera. Now, I will give some envy to our Environmental Health Department. Y'all are always in the know. Y'all know when a new restaurant's coming to town. Like, I don't know if y'all are the first to get the scoop on when there's going to be a new anything that's going to open. Because that restaurant has to, well, they have to go through the permitting process, which includes the plan review of.
Y'all are probably pretty high on the list, though, huh?
We are. Yeah. Out in the county, there's not a building inspections department. And so there are instances where, you know, we might find out when we see the concrete slab being poured and something like that. But in city limits, the likelihood that we get involved very, very early is high because we do have a relationship with the building inspections group. And so they alert us to begin that review and begin those inspections early on through the construction process. So yeah, we get a sneak peek at what's coming, but normally that, you know, it's long before that. You know, the Economic Development Board and different things, those guys definitely hear, you know, from these big chains that want to come to Tyler a lot sooner than we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
but another layer that is covered by you and your staff of sanitarians of you had talked a little bit about risk assessments that y'all have conducted with it was about 200 or so food establishments earlier this year.
So the Environmental Health Department has recently finished a program risk assessment for our retail food program. And what that entails is kind of it's a baseline measurement because this is our first one. It's just to see what is the real risk that is posed by, you know, retail food service from our food establishments in our area. You know, what is our weaknesses? And so of those 1,600, we did take a percentage that came out to somewhere around the neighborhood of about 220 food establishments of various different categories, which is, you know, the healthcare, long-term care, hospitals, our schools was a different category, full-service restaurants is another, fast food establishments, and then our retail groceries that have delis, so particularly that deli. So we're looking for those establishments that cook and cool and reheat and hold, you know, have some pretty good food handling going on in that facility. And so this risk assessment is a very, very detailed, thorough, non-scored site visit type inspection to really dive deep into their policies and practices and see through observations what's going on. You know, so it's a little bit more robust type of inspection, but it's only meant to identify, you know, just those particular risks that might be most out of control in our food systems across our jurisdiction. And so from there, we have concluded that result, compiled all that data into a report, and we now have the tally on where our risks lie. And so that's something that we're putting together into a educational type campaign over the next 3 years to try to pull those violations back into compliance and make our foods that are served in our East Texas community even more safe.
So for those listening that are considering becoming an owner, operator of a food establishment, are there, from that risk assessment, that first round, are there any eye-opening, thought-provoking, or unusual risks that y'all have identified so far from that list of 200 or so?
Yeah, I would not say it's, you know, unusual. Those are items that are our certified food managers and things are completely aware of. And so, you know, as food handling, so hand washing opportunities is something that is observed. Another is cooking temperatures, date marks, holding temperatures. Once the food's prepared and put in our sandwich make tables, just the observation of the temperatures throughout the day, you know, in those units and things like that. or hot holding if it's on a buffet line or something like that. Is it staying hot while it's out there on that line, or is it, you know, cooling off and needs to be reheated? So it's just monitoring, which is taught in our educational classes, but it's just a focus. It's a increased focus on that attentiveness to those things that will cause foodborne illness. And so, the CDC, we have the luxury of living in the day that we do live in. In the 1970s, it was very eye-opening, revolutionary in terms of environmental health for the United States. So that's where we got the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the RCRA laws for Superfund sites to clean up the pollution that had occurred over the past, decades or centuries through the Industrial Revolution and all. But that's when food safety laws started really moving forward. And so over those decades since, the FDA has compiled data on 10-year increments to find out where our foodborne illnesses are coming from. And it repeatedly boils down to five basic things. It's foods coming from inspected sources or food or, permitted sources, foods that are not fully cooked, all the way to the proper cooking temperature to kill the germs that are naturally associated with those foods, holding temperatures, and then hygiene of the employees, and then just sheer contamination, so not cleaning and sanitizing surfaces.
I'm glad you served up one of those. I'm going to spike this point. Speaking with our environmental health director, to everybody listening, please make sure you wash your hands, whether you work at a food establishment or not. So I was a waiter for about 8 years, and even in my role as community wellness director for NetHealth, I've seen stats and read many sources of literature that shows that a majority of contagion, communicable diseases, can often be boiled down to people just not washing their hands. It's as simple as that.
As simple as that.
There's just no way to wordsmith it or sugarcoat it.
I was at a place the other day, and you go in these restrooms and it says employees must wash hands. As if only employees need to wash hands.
If y'all could have saw Thomas's face as he was trying to say that. It seems self-explanatory.
Yeah, but it's almost kind of like as if you're not employed, you don't have to. Mm-hmm. But it's underneath it, it should be whether you're an employee or not, wash your dang hands. Wash your grimy hands.
It's almost like you want to have a wash sink at the entrance, even before you even walk in.
Yeah.
As a customer, you wash your hands. Yeah. And I guess in the back of the house, before you walk in, starting your shift, as an employee, you should wash your hands.
Incredibly important.
There are moments throughout your work day, if you're working at a food establishment, you should be washing your hands. And then just in everybody's normal day, just normal activity days of living.
Between tasks. That's the term that we use as we try to talk about hand washing. And so you're working with one job, but you finish that job, you stop, wash your hands before you pick up a next item or next job duty. So if we're handling raw chicken at one moment in time, we finish up that prep, we put everything away, we wash our hands before we go begin salad prep, right? You don't want to transfer raw salmonella or campylobacter into our ready-to-eat salads, right? And so that's an example. But over the course of our entire day, think about it. From the time you wake up, brush your teeth, fix your hair, go pet the dog, take the trash out, and what are you doing? And so whatever you touch, you're going to pick up germs. And whatever you touch next, you're going to drop germs off and pick germs up. And so that's kind of the example of cross-contamination. And so in the commercial world specifically, you want to lose those germs and keep those germs isolated so that we don't have that transferred risk of causing a foodborne illness inadvertently. And so That's really our focus. Some people have a misconception. You know, they walk in, they put a pair of gloves on and handle everything. And so it's not necessarily the germs that are from you as a person, although there are some. Like if you don't wash your hands well after using the restroom, you know, you could have those fecal germs, which cause lots of foodborne illnesses. But, you know, or staph, you know, our skin has staph naturally associated with it many times. And so, of course, you know, if we don't wash our hands well, we can transfer those germs too. But there's really more risk in the fact of changing tasks throughout your prep time, you know. So
like if you're preparing food and then you go to cash out the employee, handle the money, answer the phone, open the door for a customer in and out.
Exactly. So whether it's a bare hand or a glove,
it's all the same.
Cause cross-contamination.
Well, I can't even, when I prep my chicken, I trim my chicken, I trim all the fat and stuff off my chicken at home. I can't even grab anything else after I've grabbed I don't know
how. Like it feels.
Yeah, like I have to wash my hands after I mess with
there's nothing. You got to grab everything with your elbows or your knee to open the door.
Like I'm immediately
until you wash your hands.
Washing my hands right after I handle my chicken. Like I can't touch my knives. That's nasty.
So that's ultimate gross example.
Yeah.
For sure. But, you know, so in our world, that's what drives things home, you know, is that ew or that gross, you know. So, you know, bringing it to your forefront of your thoughts, and it's like, oh, man, yeah, okay, that makes sense, you know. But so chicken's a classic example because it is just nasty, you know, just to kind of handle and stuff like that. But there's other things, you know, thinking about, you know, prepping things down a buffet line or something like that. What are you handling? You know, so grabbing the fajita meat or grabbing, you know, just the various different kinds of things. You don't necessarily want to touch something different. I'll use one of our examples from, you know, one of our fast food chains is, you know, it's not only, you know, those pathogens that cause foodborne illnesses that they're worried about. It's also allergens, you know, so people that have Crohn's disease or things like that, or the gluten, you know, issues or lactose issues, or, you know, nut allergies or shellfish allergies, you know. So that is something that's working its way into our food code. Each legislative cycle is just more and more education and more concern for those things that cause major allergy kind of reactions. And so making sure that we wash the hands and change the utensils and change the gloves and things between each job, staying isolated on those jobs and not jump off of it and go handle all kinds of other stuff, because that's where foodborne illnesses can occur for sure.
Terrence, are you allergic to anything?
Not that I know of, but I've always wanted to have one of those allergy tests where they take a chunk out of your leg and
what?
They test.
Why would you want that?
Because I
want
to know what I'm allergic to. I don't know what I'm allergic to.
I think they can do the little.
Are they out of your arm?
Arm. They'll do little areas.
Oh, yeah,
they'll section off the little area.
Yeah, but panel of.
I'm assuming I'm allergic
needles,
to mold,
you know,
and dust and pollen, but like actual food allergies, I don't.
Are you allergic to anything, Ginger?
Not that I am allergic to nickel.
Nickel. Interesting. Mm-hmm. That's pretty unique.
What contains nickel?
A lot of different metals, but
like alloys and stuff that are mixed with it?
Yes. And so growing up, my watch band would make a nice big itchy rash underneath the latch.
The contact dermatitis.
Exactly. And so that was number one thing. And then I went to volleyball camp and wore the dorm key around my neck. And you got a nice itchy rash around where the key was dangling. So,
dang.
Yeah. All right.
No
fun.
I don't know what food items I'm allergic to, but I am allergic to Neosporin.
Oh yeah, you did mention that.
There was a time
day.
I had a cut on my chest, and I did the Neosporin on the bandage to cover it up to keep it concealed. You know, keep the air out and going to change the bandage just 2 days later, and It had developed into a rash. That's when I learned the term contact dermatitis.
That was pretty recent, right?
I don't know. That's been a good 15, 20 years ago. It was a long time ago.
Well, I remember we were talking about it like just a few weeks ago. You had mentioned, because I had mentioned if you'd ever used like triple antibiotic or like bacitracin.
Yeah.
Which is basically just to keep the skin moist so it can grow back properly. Because what happens is like your skin ends up bunching up. If you let it dry, that's what causes like the ridges. And that's what, that's what causes
where it looks.
Yeah.
Look like the top of a ball guy's head.
Yeah.
The wrinkly look.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I'm not allergic to, I don't think I'm allergic to any foods. I've been very fortunate. I had a few friends in high school that were like, they'd have to get like a shot like every other week because they were just, they were like allergic to just so much stuff.
It is awful.
It's like,
it's real.
Heck of a way to live.
This topic that we're on prevention of food allergies, I'm going to pepper around so I can serve up another topic. See, I'm trying to weave in those volleyball. I don't know, is that a simile or a metaphor? I don't remember that from English class, but you and your staff, you inspect, but you also educate. You also evaluate. You also support food establishments. So there's a misconception that I feel that our environmental health department does not close a food establishment. You can close them temporarily if they have enough infractions, enough demerits, or they're causing a legitimate risk of public safety, but you don't just outright say, no, y'all cannot operate anymore. You're just...
Right.
And that's not the goal.
You can't force a business to close.
You want as you said, you want the program that y'all enforce to be successful.
So what I've been told is that the most common reason that a business may close is because they're not making enough money. They're just not generating the profit to keep the lights on and keep the doors open. And also, as a lifelong Tylerite, I feel like for those Marvel fans, restaurants are kind of like a Hydra. One closes and another one opens. Like
you cut one head off.
Cut the head off and two more open. That's why we have 1,682.
It is very competitive.
Food establishments in Smith County.
It is. It's very competitive. It's huge, you know. So yes, yeah, the food industry in our area is a gigantic economic income, you know. And so it's one, important for our economy, but two, it's important for us because we do eat out so often these days. I remember growing up, that was about, we're either out of town eating, not home, or it's a celebration of some kind, like our birthday. You know, we went out to eat on our birthday, but now it's, I eat out a whole lot more than I eat at home, for sure, you know. So it's important. It's important for our economy. And so that is not a goal, to close places down. It is a goal to keep places open, but it's a partnership. You know, it's a partnership between, our inspectors and the food establishment operators, and it's only as strong as their active managerial control. You know, that's a big push. It's a big focus, is that trying to educate, the people in charge and get them to buy into those food safety risks and concerns and parameters that need to be kept in place and maintain that what we call active managerial control, make sure things stay in check. And so, that's always a focus. Can we close places? Sure. You know, there's other things that we call a imminent hazard. And so that's something that is a direct threat to the health and safety of the public. So if they don't have electricity, for instance, they don't have a way to maintain temperature controls or cook foods adequately, that could cause a closure. No water, no hot water. Can cause a closure. Rodent or pest infestation obviously can cause lack of refrigeration. If they have lots of refrigeration units and several of them are down and they don't have a way to keep and hold foods at the right temperatures, that could be a risky situation. So it could close, you know, an establishment. But, you know, so we definitely look out for those imminent threats. But there's other instances where cumulatively there is a lot of different things wrong. And so if they cannot correct things by the time that we're finished with our inspection, and it's still at the end of that inspection is too risky and, you know, equivalent of an imminent health hazard, then we could make that decision to close an establishment. But we do whatever we can do to make sure that they can maintain food safety before we leave that establishment. So
it sounds like you're wanting to make sure you're ensuring the protection of the health of the consumer.
That's right.
Yeah, first and foremost.
First and foremost, yeah. So that's, you know.
And that kind of goes back to what I mentioned earlier. When we walk into a restaurant, into a food establishment, we have that assumption that everything is okay because it's open, because we're able.
And you would expect that a business owner opening a business, you would think if you're going into the industry of serving food to people, that should be at the top of their list too. It's like, but of course it's like, well, I'm trying to make money. It's like, but before, it's like you're in the industry of serving, you know, serving individuals. It's like,
and you want to keep having customers,
right? Like if you make them sick, they're not going to come back. So it's like,
right. So, you know, filth, that's a nasty that people will definitely talk about, but also the rumor that people get sick, you know. So if people claim to get sick from your food establishment, then that is, and they're going to go tell everybody, you know, that they know, and so that word spreads, and so that is very dangerous to a to the livelihood of that food establishment. So none of that is good. So food safety should be the bare basic forefront and forethought behind all their policies and practices. But yeah, you know, sometimes that is overlooked. You know, people can cut corners. You know, we have those A students and we have those D students, you know, that have food establishments. And so that's why we're here, you know, is to try to do what we can do to educate. But if we cannot educate into compliance, then, you know, we do have a route of administrative penalty or closure if we have to get to that point. You know, I think that is, you know, something that we had run across in history since I've been working for the health district. Let's see, probably before 2011, the health district, as a government entity, did not have the ability to apply administrative penalty, which is a monetary penalty fee for various violations. The only tool that we had in our tool belt for compliance measures, if an establishment did not fix something that we put them on notice for, was to suspend the permit. And so I think that's where locally we've gotten a viewpoint from a lot of our old longstanding food establishments that maybe being a little heavy-handed. But that was simply because of the way that our government makeup was composed of in our abilities. And so our advocacy with our local Texas Restaurant Association, we you know, they've expressed some of those concerns, and we explained those same concerns, and we together kind of banded together to put together a piece of legislation to push through the Texas legislature to allow public health districts to apply administrative penalties like the state, you know, and other various government entities. And so that has opened up a lot more avenues for us to further our education into compliance kind of standard. And it's also allowed us to conform to more of a national standard of practice for our retail food program by, you know, setting those stair-stepped levels of compliance for those various items. And it's helped. It has been very beneficial to our program. And I think it's just taken a few years for us to kind of overcome some of those viewpoints, you know, from some of our establishments and things. But
so going back what you're saying is before you would just have to suspend the license, but now you can actually, instead of going that route first and foremost, you can kind of be like, hey, we're gonna penalize you and we're gonna charge you for it. You still get to keep your license, but it's like an additional layer of we don't have to go to the extreme just yet.
Correct.
And beforehand, you were saying it was very heavy-handed because that's all you had. That's the only option you had was to suspend the license.
Yeah. And so for items that are not imminent, you know, it's not – it's wrong behavior. It's against the rules. But it's not going to make somebody sick today, you know. And so for those items, you know, the way that our – inspection sheet is built and structured. It's risk based and it's weighted. And so those items that are highly likely to cause foodborne illness, you know, we put them on notice if they can't fix it during the course of the inspection. And we have to ensure that it's fixed within 24 hours, no greater than 3 days, you know, depending on the violation and things that are going on. And if it's kind of a building block to that risky behavior, then those things, if they cannot be corrected on site, it's fix it within a week, mm-hmm. you know, so a little bit longer, not as risky, a little bit, you know, but it still needs to be fixed or repaired. So we'll come back at the end of that time frame and verify safety. And then we have things that are called core items. That might be a hole in the wall, you know, something that's kind of more structurally wrong, not as risky, not causing a direct threat to food safety at the moment, but could lead to a hiding place for pests, which could then contaminate food. So it's really driven to drill down to the root cause of the issue and give an appropriate time frame for repairs. And so that's our typical mode is we come in for an inspection. We expect a corrective action on site. We'll educate you about you know, the why behind the, you know, why this is a rule and why it's important to keep it in control, you know, and then we'll go on from there. But if we come in, if we have something that we put on notice, like a refrigerator being out of temperature, not maintaining temperature, if the food's necessary to discard, we'll discard it. We'll put the cooler on notice for a follow-up and come back to verify that it's repaired and holding temperature before they can put it back online. Well, if we come back for that follow-up inspection and they have not fixed it, then that's the decision-making time is, well, what do we do here? What do we do now? We put you on notice to have something fixed and you didn't do it. So why? You know, why didn't you fix it? And so historically, that could be a reason to close somebody because they failed to comply with the mm-hmm. notice given. Is that worthy of a closure? No, not necessarily if things are still being maintained. So now if it's not repaired on that follow-up notice time frame, that compliance visit, then it could be an administrative penalty. Mm-hmm. As opposed to closing a place.
Seems reasonable.
You know, so super reasonable. Super right. reasonable. And so that's definitely our goal and our focus now since 2011 has been to try to, you know, be reasonable, be fair, do what we can do to maintain that level of food safety and work through these compliance issues with these establishments. And so now with that policy and procedure and things in place, now it's just down to inspections, getting around to inspections at a frequent enough interval to make sure that that's happening.
Mm-hmm. So as you described that, the word that popped in my mind was grace.
Yeah.
Y'all extend grace in helping the establishment get back up to speed or on their feet, whatever term you want to use. Y'all aren't out there. You're not hiding in secrecy and then you're just waiting on one day and they go, I got you.
Gotcha.
I found you.
Yeah.
And then y'all aren't like that. It's totally opposite.
Not the goal. No. Because, I mean, that's, you can, you know, it is a very, very rare occasion that you're going to stare at an inspection sheet and see a zero, you know, zero demerits, a perfect score. You know, stuff happens. Stuff in a retail food establishment is very fluid. You know, there's a lot of moving parts.
These are the not just the what y'all would term the brick and mortar establishments, the physical locations. I also want to bring up temporary food events, the health fairs, the community events, the carnivals, festivals at city parks, whether it's a one-day only event or if it's a multi-day event. You know, those count as food establishments also.
That is true.
And so they still have to have the same configuration of preparing items as if they were a physical in-place food establishment.
That is true, yes. So again, you know, that's going back to anybody that's offering food for human consumption, regardless of sale. And, you know, does it require temperature control to maintain the food safety, or is it open food handling? You know, so if you are offering food to the public, you know, outside your family, outside your intimate guests that you invite to your home or to your party, outside your church congregation, you know, we don't get involved in those private, intimate events.
So
you know?
If I've been married for 25 years, so if I'm getting married, or when my youngest daughter, when she wants to get married, and we're going to have food at the wedding, do I need to contact the Environment and Health Department?
Good example. You know, so that is a private event. The question there becomes, who is bringing food? Who is conducting food service? And so if it's the wedding party or those that are in the invited guests, the answer is no, we do not need to come inspect, because it's a private occasion. However, you know, if you're going to hire a caterer, that caterer should be an inspected permitted business.
Or a venue, the venue itself.
Yeah. So who is making the food and bringing the food?
So if it's being catered by a restaurant that already has an active permit with our Environmental Health Department, then I would be in the clear.
Should be in the clear, yes, yes, yes.
If it's somebody that doesn't have a permit, that isn't registered or known by our Environmental Health Department, or if they're operate in a different county, and I'm hiring them for my daughter's wedding being held here in Smith County, or if it's a pasture party, or I don't know what kind of wedding she's going to want to have, but I'm kind of thinking ahead, maybe a couple years down the line, but I want to be ready just in case. But if it's somebody outside of the area, I want them to provide food at my private event, then I should contact
the Environmental Health Department, yes.
And go through the proper procedure.
Right. And so
if there's any forms that need to be completed.
A lot of times, you know, that's a one-time event, and we can work through what we call the temporary event, you know, route for food services. So that's our most liberal permit. It is meant for the single event or the celebration, and to allow for us to do our job in evaluating those five risk factors that the FDA has kind of lined out for us. So that's what we'll do. We'll figure out where the source of the food is, make sure it's coming from a safe source, make sure that they have the means to conduct, you know, the proper cooking, transportation, holding of those temperature controlled items, and then the means to handle food safely with safe, healthy staff, you know. So that's the five things that we kind of monitor over the course of those temporary events to make sure that the public can stay safe. Yeah. And so wedding reception, you know, the church example that we often give, you know, the private congregation we don't get involved in. But then we look to fundraisers, you know, serving the weekly meals or the fundraiser dinners and things of that sort. It depends on who the audience is. You know, my church, every last weekend of the month, we have birthday anniversary supper. And it's a potluck. Everybody brings what they want to bring. But it's only the church congregation that is served. But if it were a fundraiser, a spaghetti dinner, you know, is it only open to the congregation? Or are we going to turn the marquee out by the road around and have everybody come buy a $5 spaghetti plate, right, to send the kids to youth camp or something like that? So if you're going to invite those public guests into your food service, then that's when that temporary event permit application would be needed from our Environmental Health Department, just to make sure that anybody that you serve that spaghetti plate to is going to consume the food, be happy, safe, healthy, you name it.
Right? So it's still a fundraiser. But it's still a fundraiser. You've turned it into a place of business.
Essentially.
For that temporary, that one time, one day
activity. Yeah, so you're pushing, you're increasing the volume, but you've also lost the intimate knowledge of who you're serving. And so you don't know who has that food allergy. You don't know their chronic disease or their chronic illness. And so in those instances, we need to make sure that we've got those extra food safety precautions and we're following those food rules that are set by our Texas food law to make sure that foods are served in a safe manner. And you've got the means to do it.
Yeah. I'm out of volleyball analogies or similes, whatever the word is. So we've served up some good info. We've set everybody up with information. We've volleyed from one topic to the next. We've spiked the message about hand washing.
You gotta dig.
Now, well, we gotta, okay, dig this, y'all. Our Environmental Health Department covers more than just food. There are many other categories of environments.
Yes.
That you cover. So, that's a sound that only you can only hear that sound if you work at a health department. So it's an acronym, y'all. It's PIWF. Did I spell it correct, Ginger?
Yes, you did.
So, water, I guess, would be another category to cover. So there's my tie-in with the limnography.
There you go, limnology.
Limnology. I forgot the word. Limnology. So y'all cover public pools. So if I just live in a house and I have a pool in my backyard, would I need to contact our Environmental Health Department for checking on my pool? If it's my private pool?
No.
It's my pool that I bought, I spent my good money on.
Dug the hole?
Well, I probably didn't dug the hole. But if I did, if it was my own pool, just me and my family using it, then y'all wouldn't get involved. But if it's a pool that's open to the general public, say it's a pool at an apartment
larger,
complex.
Anything larger than a duplex.
Larger than a duplex.
Yes.
So if it's a pool shared in HOA.
We inspect it.
If it's a neighborhood pool.
We inspect that,
A pool
too.
At an apartment complex.
Yes.
You know, the obvious examples for those that live in the Tyler area is Fun Forest Pool. There's the aquatics pool at Tyler ISD.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the only two pools I know of in Tyler. I'm sure there are others. There's Tyler Tennis and Swim.
There you go.
They got a pool there. I'm just kind of thinking of just open to the general public type pools. Are there others, Ginger? Like, is that it?
That's the biggest majority that are open to the public. There are other pools that are typically what we call a Class C pool. It's only for the guests served, you know, like the HOA. It's only for that community, or the apartment. It's only for the apartment and their guests that they bring, you know. So those are typically considered a Class C pool. It is a public pool, but not general public. But sometimes they open for a party of sorts, you know. And so during those courses of time, that Class C pool would bump up a level to what we call a Class B, that public pool. And that's open to anybody and everybody to come swim. It might be for a charge or just free.
So like a pool at a hotel?
Yeah.
That'd be a Class C?
That's typically a Class C, yes. But if you wanted to have swim lessons there every Wednesday, then during those times that would be a Class B. Yeah.
Okay.
Something to that effect.
So then that naturally leads me to ask, how could we get a Class A pool?
A Class A is a competition pool. So that would be TISD.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So every pool at the Olympics in Paris, that would be a Class A pool?
Those guys were Class A.
You would hope they were Class A? Okay, the Seine River probably wasn't a Class A.
Oh, yeah. That's another public health topic, definitely. As an environmental topic, it is.
That's true swimming. If you can swim in a river, I've played in a river, you know, tubed in the Comal River, New Braunfels area, but actual legitimately swim in a river. I've never done that before.
Weren't people?
I don't know if I want to.
Weren't people wasn't it like fecal infested? Because they were getting sick.
They
right?
were, right, yeah.
Because there was a debate whether they should continue having some of the aquatic events in the Seine River.
I don't know how to pronounce it.
However it's pronounced in correct French.
Well, apparently there were people that were actively going down there to basically protest because they didn't want it to happen. Mm-hmm. So they were like actively trying to make it more disgusting so they would deter.
They were helping their own cause, I guess you could say.
It's like, gross.
Well, and that is environmental health at its finest right there. You know, that's again, you know, kind of going back to us in the 1970s and all that with the Clean Water Act. That's what we have run into. I know the Neches River where I grew up, it was highly polluted, not only water but air as well. I remember there's stories that my professors would say that, you know, ladies' pantyhose would melt off their legs. And just the air quality down there was awful.
Oh, even before you get in the water?
With the refineries going on. But yeah, but then you think about all those refineries and all that industrial pollution that was dumped into the rivers, and the river was just horrendous. You know, and so over the course of his tenure there at the college, they worked through a lot of those issues and things, and the river is cleaned up considerably.
So they added more than just baking soda to clean it up.
Oh,
right?
Yes, 100%. Mm-hmm.
Had you by any chance seen that film? I think it's with Mark Ruffalo, and it was like DuPont. It might be called like, it's either Dark Water or are you familiar? Does that ring a bell?
No, not that one, I don't guess.
You should check it out.
I should check that one out.
Big.
But a quick podcast plug. If y'all know what movie Thomas is referring to, if you'll please send us an email. It's castingthenet@netphd.org. I want to know what the name of that movie is.
Those are fun.
Yeah, it's Dark Waters.
It's Dark
Waters. No, like, don't get the name.
It's Dark Waters.
All the public health nerds out there. Yes. Yeah. You know, that's fun. You know, we love it. I eat that stuff up. I like the Netflix series, The Dirty Cities. That one's fun to watch. You know, the movie Contagion. That one's fun.
Mm-hmm.
The book, The Jungle.
So kind of a PTSD flashback. I remember watching some of those public health-related movies when the pandemic started. You know, because you're at home, couldn't go anywhere. You had to find stuff to entertain yourself in your own way. And so the movie Contagion, I remember it came out specifically in 1995. I was a junior in high school. Like you had said about yourself earlier, I had no interest, knowledge, involvement with public health in the 90s. I remember the movie coming out, and it just went over my head because I just wasn't interested in that topic, in that field. And now, working in public health, you want to look and watch and consume any kind of entertainment that may relate to public health. So sometime soon, I'm going to look up that movie, Dark Waters, just to get some more intel on it.
So just a brief description.
Got some more tidbits on it.
So it was a case where DuPont was getting rid of some of their forever chemicals. It's actually been proven that likely us three here have forever chemicals in our body because of some of these things that have been created and that they got into.
You're saying we're eternal?
Well,
parts of our The more organs may be.
Yeah. But, you know, Teflon, you know, some of our pans and stuff. And some of these chemicals, I mean, it's like there's like a 99.98% chance that all three of us have these chemicals in our body because of some of these. They're called PFAS.
Yes. PFAS. That's a big issue right now.
And DuPont, back in the, I believe it was in the 70s, they were dumping a lot of these, like burn off and stuff from these chemicals. They were just like dumping it illegally. A bunch of people's cattle and stuff were dying. People's teeth were rotting out and stuff in the communities that were like right next door. But DuPont was played a big part in that community. So it was like, we can't get rid of DuPont because they basically build our parks. They build our housing communities. They build our schools. They build. So it's kind of like, what do we do? So
what I'm hearing is we may be entitled to financial compensation.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they tried to, yeah, they basically, you know, obviously they weren't hurting. You know, it didn't hurt them really any. I mean, DuPont's still in business and, you know, they still make these chemicals and it's like it.
But that is
it. Like, it's like if you're. It's like, you know, the whole deal. If you still want to buy our pans, it's on you.
Assumed risk.
But it is becoming, you know, they're writing legislation and stuff for that now, you know.
Hey, I only use cast iron.
To try to keep it out of the waterways.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, but that, you know, it's just something, you know, we take life for granted in everything we do. You know, it's true. We've been very blessed in the time that we live to have all of the safety nets that we have in place, you know. And so, you know, you go to the grocery store, you buy foods off the shelf, you take it for granted that it's safe, you know, whereas in history, it is not necessarily the case, you know. So, you know, same thing with the water that we drink out of the tap, you know, it does get inspected and has lots of requirements in place to keep these bad chemicals and things out. And so we take it for granted. Is it perfect? No, but that's why routine tests, routine inspections, routine things need to be in place to maintain safety.
I'm gonna pause you on that on water, and you're talking about tap water.
Yes.
It's assumed, well, not assumed, I don't know what word to use, but your department is relied upon whenever we have a boil water notice. That's when tap water becomes
the forefront of everybody's mind.
It's like, oh, yeah. Like,
how
am I going to cook things at my house now if the water is being deemed unsafe because a boil water notice has been issued by my water provider? So this is kind of a connect point with all three of us because Mr. Thomas here, as the time of this podcast being recorded, is preparing to move into your...
Man, don't be airing out all my business, Terrence.
Okay.
No. You're
changing your mailing address. I'll put it that way. But you had mentioned to me that you had learned that you are going to have a new water utility provider.
That is correct.
And where you're living at now is still physically within the city limits of Tyler?
Yeah, we're right on the cusp. So,
but you're not under the
Chapel Hill area.
But you're not under the Tyler Water Utilities.
No.
So you're close enough where you would think that you would be under the city of Tyler water supply system.
Yeah.
But because of however many water supply companies we have just here in the Tyler area. Like, talking with our laboratory director, it was like 40 or 50 or so different water supply providers just here in Smith County.
Yeah.
Like, there's more than just one.
There's quite a few. Mm-hmm. There are.
So whenever and this happened once or twice earlier in this calendar year, where one company issued a boil water notice, but it did not affect everybody within the city of Tyler. There is a different water supply company that issued a different boil water notice that affected their customers, but it didn't affect city of Tyler water supply customers. So there's another level of education that we have to make sure that we're aware of, that we hit when boil water notices occur. And how it relates to you, Ginger, is whenever there's a food establishment within a boil water notice that's being issued. Because I've had a few family and friends that have talked to me over this past year whenever specific restaurants were closed during a boil water notice for whatever reason. And it's like, why were they closed? Well, probably because they couldn't boil their water
they
at
don't
their
have
restaurant.
Yeah, so that is a huge and pressing issue for us to focus on and improve, you know, our own means to react, you know, and oversee and monitor the safety of the food establishments in our area. And that's around the emergency action plans that each food establishment has in place. So the food code by default, you know, says if you have an imminent hazard present, then you need to suspend food service, or you have some alternate emergency action plan in place and approved by your health department, pretty much. That's pretty much what it says. And so historically, you know, going back in history when I hired on, it was, you know, if you have an imminent hazard present, you close. End of story. You know, that's, there's no other ifs, ands, ors, or buts. But in recent history, there's been some pressure, especially from our small towns that are on small water utilities that have experienced frequent boil water notices. And so they need an alternate means to be able to maintain some kind of income in the economy, the local economy, while they're working on some of these repairs and things. And so the state already has a way for food establishments to try to evaluate themselves to see if there's a level of safety. And so NetHealth has pretty well followed suit, but that has presented some other challenges in itself. You know, so namely, you know, you have a water utility that's affected. You've got, you know, multiple food establishments on this same system. You've got half of them with emergency action plans in place and half of them that aren't, that don't have an emergency action plan in place and are expected to close. And, you know, but they're sitting there staring out the door looking at these other food establishments that are open, and they're like, why do they get to open and I don't? You know, so that's posed another level of assurance in our minds. You know, some people will open and they either, you know, should be closed or should do something that's right, and then they, you know, they tend to cut corners and put our public at risk, and that's concerning in our mind, you know. And so we're trying to improve not only our review of those emergency action plans to make sure that these establishments are prepared for the if and for the when these emergencies occur, but also a means of mass notification of so for any of our establishments that are on a particular water utility, how can we push this notification to those guys to say, hey, a water notice has been issued, you know, here's the requirements. You know, if you've got an emergency action plan in place, it's time to pull it out and set those alternative methods of production up. Or if you don't have the means to do it, stay closed, you know, during this time frame. And then that will help us to triage, you know, the effects of the incident to be able to send our staff and reroute our staff for monitoring during the course of those events. So it's a huge focus for us on the commercial world, on the commercial side, but it's also important for us to educate the consumer at home.
And so if somebody's going to open a restaurant, a food establishment, then it would be in their best interest to have an emergency action plan as they're developing when and where and how they want to start their food establishment. That way they already have that layer already taken care of in case they are within that area that may have a boil water notice.
Correct.
Not talking it into existence, but just being prepared.
Be prepared. Whatever you choose to do, you know. So that is on all of our plan review applications that come through. If you want to open an establishment, you have certain policies and things that food code requires you to have in place. And that imminent hazard plan is one of those. So the difficulty there is a lot of times on those initial plans, they'll say, I'm not going to open. But then over the course of time, when an event occurs, then they want to open, you know. And so during an emergency is not a time to ask the health department, you know, for approval to open, just because we're so slammed with trying to respond to the incident at hand. But so it is important to think through those various incidents to try to prepare, you know, prepare your plan. And we do have a good policy template and place that you can ask for. Definitely, it was produced by the Conference for Food Protection. Those guys, you know, it's a group of stakeholders that actually meet and discuss issues that actually get implemented and amend the food code that we all are required to operate by. And so that's, you know, it's industry is a big player in the development of those food rules, actually. And so it's a really, really good set of standards that are reasonable for food establishments to adopt. And so that's what we have turned to as our template. And so if you ask for that from our department, we can definitely get you a copy so that you can start putting a policy together and thinking through those things. But it's
a lot to consider.
It's big.
So yeah. It's maybe I don't want to do a side hustle in the food industry. I'll just enjoy my cookies and cakes in the comforts of my home.
That Betty Crocker.
Yeah. I know. It's complicated. I don't envy the industry. You know, it is. They've got a lot of moving parts, you know. And food safety is the bare basic. It's important, but bare basic. You know, you've got to worry about customer satisfaction and sales and inflation on all your groceries and all that kind of stuff. It's hard. It's a hard world.
But for when y'all may need to go to any of the 1,682 food establishments in Smith County, you can guarantee that they have been evaluated, reviewed, inspected, and are safe for you to enjoy whatever meal you may have. So just off topic, just fun question for you, Ginger. Do you have a favorite cuisine, the favorite type of food that you like to eat, because you have 1,682 different options to choose from?
No. I do not.
You do not? You're like me.
I am not a picky eater.
I would literally eat. Well, I won't say anything. So a few years ago, we get to go on, I guess you can say, work vacations, going on conferences to different cities, and I went to this conference in Austin. The only reason I remember, I went to a food truck park on, it's kind of near Zilker Park. And just on a whim, I ordered duck pate just to try, because I never had duck pate. And as soon as I took that first bite, I realized, why did I order duck pate from a food truck? But secondly, just realizing what duck pate actually is, that's the only time I've ever tried. My taste buds are not accustomed to the texture, the sensation, the flavor profile.
The color of the duck.
The color of the duck. I say that because I was going to say, I'll literally eat anything. But that's one thing I will not eat.
I don't discriminate when it comes to food, man.
Mm-mm.
Let me rephrase.
No,
I don't discriminate at all. But when
whether it's from a food truck or not, have some duck pate. And if y'all like duck pate, let us know by emailing us at castingthenet at netphd.org. But also, because we have a wide variety of food options, it seems like Tyler, and I'll just say the Tyler area, because this is even in cities outside of Tyler, the unincorporated areas outside of Tyler, of how we're having more food options, more cuisines, just pun intended, we're becoming a melting pot because we have two hospital systems, because we have three universities, because we are a nationally recognized retirement community, we're a nationally recognized Alzheimer's community. We're a nationally recognized veterans community. There are many communities that converge for whatever reason. Tyler has become a magnet, an international magnet. So Tyler Junior College, TJC, has had national soccer teams, tennis teams, golf teams, and they get students from all over the world deliberately, purposely attend TJC of all places and wonder, well, why TJC? Why they pick TJC other than UT Austin and A&M and Baylor? And like, they're coming to Tyler, and this worldwide culture is bringing their food here also, because there's me being here, born and raised here, I'm thinking, I don't remember there being a wide Vietnamese culture, Chinese, Japanese restaurants. I don't remember as many being here when I was in high school in the 90s, even the 2000s. And now it's like of all the Thai restaurants, all the Japanese steakhouses and kitchens, buffets that we have, it's paralysis by analysis trying to think of which places to go and which one. Well, I haven't been there yet. I want to go there next. And it's good, but it's kind of not good also. It's like it's too much, or there are too many options.
it's very competitive. Yeah. And so they have to perform in order to maintain enough business to make it float in today's time and all of that. So it's a hot market. Mobile foods are a very good entrepreneurial step into the food market, but it's the most complicated permit that you can operate under. I'm not going to say the most complicated to obtain. It is very attainable, but the overhead and the rules and regulations above and beyond food permit are a challenge to work through.
So what I'm hearing, it's not cheap.
It is
Have a food truck, to be a mobile.
It's not cheap.
Or in the what I would envision of being a mobile food operator, the traditional food truck is not what you're saying, isn't.
It's cheaper to buy the unit and probably, definitely than a brick and mortar, but the everything else that goes along with the food vehicle is expensive, so they still have to have fire suppression inspections. They still have to have the vent hood and things. That's a huge expense. They still have to be tied to a base operation somewhere, which is another expense. They still have to have city inspections or permits to do business in town, kind of like an occupancy license or something, a peddler's permit of some kind, which is – those rules are different. Where can you go? Where can you park? Where can you sell? In each of these towns that are within Smith County, there's different rules and requirements and different fees associated with it. So we always try to describe, you need to keep four people happy. You need to keep the health department happy. You need to keep the fire marshal happy. You need to keep the municipality or the city zoning department happy. And of course, the property owner, wherever you decide to park and sell, you have to keep them happy too. And that changes. If you're in the county area versus you're in the city, this city versus that city, or if, are you in the same health department jurisdiction? If you're going to drive to Kilgore and operate, well, that's a different health department. And there's 20, 23 different health departments in the Northeast Texas area, so it's a mess. It's a very, very, complicated type of business. But once you learn the ropes, once you get the pattern down, get everything figured out, it's okay. But it's just getting there is a challenge.
So in the words of Donkey from Shrek, There's layers.
There are layers upon layers and layers.
I think it's so easy too for people probably to watch like a movie like Chef with Jon Favreau and be like, oh, like get an idea, you know, and be like, I'm going to start a food truck. But it's like, first off, you got to have good food. I mean, that's like the bare minimum, you know.
Yes.
But then it's like everything else that comes along with it. People are just like, wait, I didn't know that there was so much that goes into all this. I thought I could just like have good food, get a truck and sell it. And it's like, no, it's not that simple.
It's not. It's not that simple. You have to be very keen on your marketing strategies and things. How are you going to advertise? You know, how are you going to tell your customers where you're at? You know, that's a big deal. And yeah, good food. And how fast can you give it to them? You know, that's where are you going to be for lunch today? And who are you going to serve? You know, how fast you got to give to? You know, so we see that for our events and things. You've got a certain amount of time to give people food, and it's hard off of a food truck. You know, you can see it all the time in big areas. You know, one of the big eye-opening moments was I was at a horse race. I think it was the Kentucky Derby. No, it was in California at Los Alamitos or something. But they had the whole infield loaded with food trucks, and that was kind of the food options. And, you know, just sitting here staring at the lines and lines of people just trying to get food off of these food trucks is just, well, it was a wow. It was a big wow moment, you know. And so trying to explain that to the individual, because a lot of times it's a chef. You know, a chef wants to embark upon this journey because he's got really good food and all that good stuff, and it's just one or two people on board, ideal kind of circumstance. But who's your audience, you know, is a big factor. If that's what you want to do and you're going to be in a food truck park and that's just your day-to-day, great. But if you're going to go cater an event or go do these temporary events and things, that's not it. You know, you really have to find a way to do advanced orders or something that's just easy assembly and easy service. So it's just,
unless you're a patient person, wanting to order something from a food truck, and you're okay with
that, needs to be on the menu board. Yeah, like, that expectation.
Serving patient customers.
Certainly. Oh my goodness. Yeah. So that's one thing that, you know, we're trying to implement here. Haven't really brought it out publicly per se, but we're looking for a way to make it easier to find these food trucks. You know, that's something that we've discovered around the nation, around Texas for certain, but and we're not unique in any way. It is hard to find a food truck, you know, because they're mobile. And so we're looking for ways to make sure that, you know, one, that we can inspect them on a routine frequency like they need to be inspected to guarantee that food safety. But we're looking for to implement a way that was beneficial for our general public too, you know, to be able to Google them up and find out where they're going to be this week or next week or whatever. And so I think that's something that we might be able to talk about on a later podcast. But
then that kind of goes back to being the owner operator of a mobile food unit, how do you market yourself? How do you advertise when and where you're going to sell? Because you still need to make a profit to stay in business as a food truck. So it's for us as NetHealth to want to help that mobile food business to stay profitable by being able to know where that food truck is going to be in business, whether it's for lunch. They may be in one part of Tyler for lunch, and then they may want to travel to White House or Lindale for dinner service.
Right. And so having that calendar out there. And so that's what we're looking at. We're looking at really drilling down and having a requirement that you post your calendar on a known location. And so a lot of people will use Facebook, but the problem is not all your consumers use Facebook. And, you know, so is that the – it might be okay, you know, for some food trucks, but I think there's a bigger market. I think it would really boost the economy of our food – mobile food industry to have it in a more public location. That's what we're – you know, they can do it on their own. There's oodles and oodles of public platforms out there that they can buy into, but – we're looking to kind of incorporate that in-house and tie it into their permitting process to make it a requirement that they post on a Google calendar, pretty much. And so it's public facing that anybody and everybody can find it. If they want to be found, you know, they'll be able to mark it as a public event that everybody's invited to, or a private event that, like, if they're catering a reception or something, that it's a private event that's not open to the public and that will not display their location. But so more to come on that. But you know, we're looking at that, and I know sometimes the thought in some people's heads is, well, that's more government and all that kind of thing, but really, we're looking after the benefit of the industry and of the not only our health department but other health departments. You know, that's being mobile. The difficulty there is, you know, trying to figure out, am I doing the right thing? You know, people generally want to do the right thing, and so trying to make sure that you're in compliance with this jurisdiction, and then you drive to that jurisdiction, are you in compliance there? Texas wide. We need to do what we can do to offer more reciprocity, the level the playing field between our jurisdiction and other jurisdictions in terms of operation for these food trucks. And I think that's what we're after. You know, if we can help line out, you know, the permitting process, the inspection process, the means to locate and find, you know, I think, you know, it will be easier for different jurisdictions to accept the permits of others, you know. So that's really the goal. That's the ultimate goal that we have, is to try to, you know, bring about a little bit more consistency, a little bit more level playing field for the health departments. Now, that's a huge conversation. You know, that in 2015 we had a mobile food stakeholders meeting that we had hosted here in Tyler, and had extreme, you know, participation from all kinds of groups. I remember, you know, city officials being there, other health departments being there, a lot of interested industry, you know, proposed owners that were interested in getting into the market and things at that meeting. And looking at this, you know, 10 years later, I think it's time again, you know, to revisit that and maybe schedule another one, because our industry has grown. You know, we've gone from about 40 mobile food units in 2016, and now we're at about 115. You know, so our local industry has grown, and there's some, now that we've got more and more mobile food units available, we've got some different kind of issues and things that are present.
So wait. You got my math mind going again. So, so 10 years ago, you said there were 40, mm-hmm. and now it's at 115.
That is
so
right.
That's almost triple in 10 years. Well, I don't know if that's, well, yes, triple. So, because double will be 80, and then it's almost 120. So in 10 years, is that based on the size of the Tyler area? Is that an expected growth rate, or has it grown faster than other cities that have about 100,000 population ish? Is it?
I don't know that statistic. Is it statistic. Fair
to say whether it's bad or fast or not fast?
Well, I think, you know, looking back.
Just hearing it sounds like that's, man, that's.
It is fast. We get applications weekly, you know, of people that are, or, you know, at least inquiries weekly to figure out what it takes to open up a mobile food establishment. And so it is. It's, you know, we get about 24, 25 plan reviews a month, and just in general. And then, you know, several of those definitely being mobile food units.
So that's like one a day.
Just about of food establishments in general. But yeah, mobile food units, divide that difference by each month and get an average. I don't know. I hadn't done that yet.
You're getting the trigonometry or calculus now.
Forget that. But several.
Just trying to do basic
just,
math.
Just several. Oh, yeah. But it is. It's a pretty good growth rate. But we saw it, you know, we saw it before 2015. We saw it coming, you know, because there was mobile food unit industry in Harris County, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio. You know, it was there. It was present. But then we had the all the TV interest in showcasing the fancy mobile food units in other areas of the nation. And so it became a big interest and idea that was trickling its way to our East Texas area. And so that was something that we saw and that we know, you know, needs some standardization. You know, it needs to be well run because there are specific challenges with that, with inspections on mobile food units. And so we wanted to make sure we stayed ahead of that and always exhibit that best practice. That's always our goal in the food program that we have here at the health district. And so, you know, that's what we look to. And so we scout. We scout other jurisdictions across the nation, across the state of Texas, to find out what works, what doesn't work, what are the most pressing challenges, and how do they overcome it. And so that's what we try to glean from and adopt here to make sure that whatever we put in place is not only beneficial for health department, but it's just overall good business for the food industry.
So like how you said, there's more to come because, you know, we hadn't hit every quote-unquote environment that is covered by our environmental health department. So
no, and we could definitely do an episode specifically just on food trucks. I mean, you could probably talk about that for a while.
A while.
So we touched on mobile food units. Mm-hmm. We covered every type of food establishment. We talked a little bit about pools, about PIFs.
Talked a little bit about pools, yeah.
But in future episodes, we'd like to invite you again, Ginger, to cover some of the other categories that we didn't get to today. Because top of mind for me is daycares, foster homes that y'all cover and address, tenant rights, licensed care facilities, sanitation, nuisance complaints.
Is there any
that I miss?
Any of the other?
I'm trying to hit
lots of topics that a sanitarian covers, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to. But then we would be remiss if we didn't give a shout out to Dolores, Jonathan, Christian, Claire, Iris. You have two Jonathans.
Both Jonathans.
Gassett and Barena.
Mm-hmm.
To Maria and Esther.
Definitely.
Is that the gang? Is that the crew?
The gang.
Do you have a term for it? Are y'all coworkers? Are you a posse? Are you a club? Are you a clique? Are y'all?
Or a team.
Your team. By Coach Ginger. Coach Points.
Yes. 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 Absolutely. No.
Southland Conference volleyball champion. Y'all don't forget that.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yes, more to come on the child care. That's our next district order that we're looking to revise and bring some updates to our area. And so that's probably first quarter of next year, I would say. It'll be a topic to discuss.
So early 25, 2025, when you will have been a 19-year employee.
Mm-hmm.
Net Health. I mean, Thomas will have been a 6-year employee. 7 years? Six years.
6 years.
I'll be a 13-year employee.
Happens pretty fast.
God willing. But thank you for your time, Ginger.
I do appreciate you coming by.
Enjoy being here.
And this is episode number 7.
Correct.
Of Casting the Net. Where we are unveiling more and more about all of the public health services that are provided by our various departments. So Ginger and Environmental Health being an example of covering just Smith County, but we have other departments that provide services that cover multiple counties across East Texas, which goes back to our company name of us being the Northeast Texas. public health district. And
stay tuned.
Dramatic pause, y'all.
Yeah, again, we appreciate you coming by, Ginger. And this has been enlightening, fun topic. Topics. But as Terrence said, hopefully we'll have Ginger back or one of our other EH sanitarians to dive in a little deeper, because as we've stated and we'll continue to state, EH has a lot to cover. So that'll be fun. So y'all stay tuned.